Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Well, good evening and welcome to the Birch Aquarium at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. My name is Nigella Hilgarth and I'm the Executive Director of the Birch Aquarium. And welcome to the latest Jeffrey B. Graham Perspectives in Ocean Science lecture. And this evening it gives me great pleasure to welcome Dr. Gabby Lasky. She got all her degrees in Germany, and I think she graduated in her PhD in 1993, and in 1994 she came straight here and hasn't left, as far as I know. So she is now an associate researcher, a lecturer here at Scripps, and very distinguished, has written many publications. And one of the things that I like most about Gabby is that she does a lot of outreach, and she helps with the High School Ocean Science Bowl that we have every year run by the aquarium, really trying to get high school kids excited about oceanography. And she is a geophysicist, so she studies really the Earth, and she's going to talk tonight about Hawaiian volcanoes and how they're formed. And I'm very, very excited about that because I have absolutely no idea. And so I'm going to learn a lot about that tonight. And anything about the deep Earth is very exciting to me. It's such an unknown world. So thank you very much, Gabby. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, and I actually have to disappoint Nigella. I actually won't talk a whole lot about how volcanoes are formed and about the actual structure inside Earth, but what I want to do tonight is to show you just how many people or how many scientists actually it takes to understand why these volcanoes are there and how they are formed. And it's actually a little bit like, if you have an illness, a mysterious illness, and you have to go to the doctor, and they send you from one specialist to the next. That's actually what we do with the Hawaiian volcanoes also. So to start with, here's a little bit of an introduction. What type of scientist is actually Earth scientist is needed? All of these are specialists that tell you different stories, different details about the Earth or the Hawaiian volcanoes. In particular, we have the geologist and the volcanist that try to explain why the volcanoes are here or the Hawaiian volcano is there. Then we have geochemists and petrologists that look at the rocks. It's like when a doctor takes a blood test and looks at the chemistry of the blood of a patient. And we have a geochemist and a petrologist who look at the rocks, the composition of the rocks, and they make educated, they tell you stories about where these rocks came from the composition of these rocks and actually the volcanic gases that come out. Geodesists, they study the structure and the shape and a change of the shape of these volcanoes. And then we have a series of geophysicists with different specializations that can also help to explain where the magma comes from that ultimately comes out of these volcanoes as lava. And I'm actually a seismologist and do imaging here, a little bit like the radiologist that takes images of the human body. I take images of the Earth's interior. Okay, to start with why the geologist tells you why are there volcanoes, well, actually, we know that from the plate tectonics that most of the volcanoes that we have actually are along plate boundaries, which are shown here, or mid-ocean ridges are also plate boundaries. Most of the volcanism is actually happening, 80% of the volcanism is happening without us ever looking at it because these are happening below the ocean here on the along mid-ocean ridges. So most of these volcanoes are along plate boundaries, and then there are some oddballs where you see in Hawaii is obviously one of those that happen in the middle of these plates. And so they are a little bit peculiar, and they cannot really explain by these processes that happen along the plate boundaries, either mid-ocean ridges where we have magma coming up, and then the rocks melt due to decompression and then come out as lava, or when oceanic plates sink beneath other plates, and then the rock melts and then comes back through the volcanoes. So in these plates, in interior of the plates, something else is going on. And that was tried to be explained in the early 60s or so, when scientists, in particular Tuso Wilson, looked at these maps of ocean topography or bathymetry and recognized that there are actually parallel island chains in a Pacific Ocean. Here, for example, the Hawaii Emperor chain, but there are also other island chains, and they seem to be parallel to each other. And then also they have a kink at about, when we date these rocks that come from these seamounts at about the same time. So the idea was that maybe these volcanoes that are along these island chains are fed from deep, from chimneys, conduits deep inside the earth, and they are relatively, they stay in place, and then the plate, in this particular case, a Pacific plate, goes, drifts above these stationary chimneys, and then these chimneys feed instantaneously a volcano, and then this plate moves along, and then the volcano loses its magma supply to produce the lava on top, and then these volcanoes go extinct. And so as you go away from the current active volcano, you see that these islands or the volcanoes on these islands grow older and older. And so, for example, in Hawaii, we actually have the old volcanoes on Kauai are now 5 million years old or so. So there's this one basic idea that these volcanoes on hotspots are fed by these deep-seated so-called mantle plumes where the plate goes above them, drifts above them. Well, at about the same time, actually, there was another idea. So this issue is very controversial, and there are at least two competing ideas why we have these volcanoes and these island chains. The other idea is that if you have a plate moving about Earth, and actually Earth is almost round or spherical, but not quite, so the curvature on different places on Earth is slightly different. So if a plate is moving about on this nearly spherical but not quite spherical Earth, plates can start cracking, and so when you open a crack in this plate, then magma can go through these cracks and then feed volcanoes on the top. So you see these ideas, both of these ideas, that plume theory and this propagating crack theory, they are actually almost equally old, and this controversy actually exists until today. So we still have these unsolved problem: what exactly feeds that volcanism? Okay, so one of the things that geoscientists do, so the geochemists and the petrologists, as I already said, they take samples of rocks or volcanic gases, and actually my colleague Dave Hilton, in his lab, he examines the volcanic gases that are trapped in the volcanic rocks in a bubbles, and he actually finds that one of those gases, helium, helium has different isotopes. That means that a helium atom can have a different number of neutrons in the nucleus. So it can have either 3 nuclei or 4 nuclei. And a one that has 3 is a little lighter than the one that has 4. And so the helium 3 is escaping easier from the atmosphere than the heavier helium 4. So it turns out that relative to the Earth's atmosphere, the gases that he gets from the samples on Hawaii, they actually have relatively more of this lighter helium than what we have in the atmosphere. And so the idea is that then this rock must have come from a deeper Earth where the volcanic gases or the gases from inside the Earth hasn't really escaped yet. So in contrast to a source that is more shallower, like where we get the lava from the mid-ocean ridges, where we think that the rocks have been recycled a couple times, and every time these rocks get recycled, we lose more and more of that helium. So that would be the doctor taking a blood test. Okay, so in the rocks themselves, we actually know that the basalts, I just indicated that a little bit, that the rocks, the basalts coming from the mid-ocean ridges are actually a little bit different from the rocks that we find on these ocean islands. The idea is that so certain elements, so what they do is, in this mass spectrometer, I was a little bit too fast here, what they actually do is that they put rocks into that machinery and then they look the relative abundance of all the elements that we have in a periodic table, the relative abundance of these elements in a rocks, and it tells you a little bit about where these rocks came from. So in a mid-ocean rich basalts and a mid-ocean rich volcanic rocks, we find that some key elements are like uranium and thorium, they are actually missing in that basalt. And so the inference is that these basalts come from this recycling process where the oceanic plates get subducted and then go through the mantle, like what's shown here, the is subducted and then travels in the upper mantle, so in the upper 600 or 700 kilometers or so, and then eventually comes back up in these mid-ocean ridges, and it goes on. And the more this is happening, the more depleted they get in these special elements. Now, in some ocean island basalts, these special elements, they are actually still there. And so it turns out that these rocks resemble more what we find in meteorites. And the idea is that the meteorites sort of resemble what we have in Earth's mantle nowadays, or actually what we have in Earth's mantle. So the idea then is that these ocean island basalts, they may come from a reservoir that has been previously untapped. We don't exactly know how deep this reservoir is, but something that has not participated in this recycling process too often. Otherwise, we would have this depleted rock. Okay? Now it turns out that Hawaii, even though it is an ocean island and it produces basalts, it actually turns out Hawaii gives us problems in that it doesn't really reveal. It actually has a little bit of both. So it behaves a little bit like a mid-ocean rich basalt and also a little bit like an ocean island rock. So it's not easy. It doesn't easily reveal its secrets. Another slight complication to this simple picture of a plume feeding the Hawaiian volcanoes is that we actually, the petrologists actually find two sequences of different types of basalts in two different age sequences. So they are a little bit out of sequence, and the chemistry is also a little bit different. So the geodynamicists who try to model, predict what's going on, and make these pretty pictures of the Earth's interior suggest that maybe there are some different plots. There's not a single plume that comes up and feeds these volcanoes, but maybe there are different. First of all, since the plate is moving, maybe this plume is sheared somewhere at depth, so it's a little bit oblique, tilted. And then maybe some blobs, every once in a while, these discrete blobs come away from this plume, from this feeding plume, and then ultimately feed these volcanoes. And so that's how we could explain the out-of-sequence eruptions of volcanoes, or the out-of-sequence age of these volcanoes, and also slight chemical differences. If we go to the doctor, first of all, we actually take our temperature. Well, the same thing we can actually do, geophysicists do, with the Earth's surface. And we measure the heat flow. So basically the amount of heat that is coming out per area near the surface. We can also do this in the oceans. This is an example that I just got from the web. Obviously deployed from a ship. This is a instrument here that is eventually penetrates into the sediments on the ocean floor and then takes the temperature, basically, in the Earth. Now, it turns out this has been done around Hawaii. And I'll show you this picture in a second. So the idea is, if we have this plume sitting beneath Hawaii and the plate goes drifts above that hotspot, that heat source, without that heat source, what is actually happening to an oceanic plate is that it ages, and once it goes away from the mid-ocean ridge. And so as it ages, it cools. And as it cools, it also gets thicker, because material gets attached to the bottom of it, and it also gets denser and heavier, and so eventually it subducts in a subduction zone. But in the meantime, if we have a plume here and this plate encounters this plume, the idea then is that this plume reheats the cooling lithosphere and, in principle, resets the clock of that plate so that it then looks like a plate of a younger age. Okay? So they took this temperature, you know, some years ago. There was actually 20 years ago. They went out with these heat flow instruments, and maybe you see this, but this here are the Hawaiian islands. This here is the Hawaiian swell. The swell is a high in a bathymetry, which is about, about 500 to a kilometer above the regular seafloor. And these red dots are the places where they took the temperature, basically. And you see the islands are here. The edge of that swell is over here. And then they also, further downstream from the islands of Hawaii, they went across the swell also. Now, when they looked in the profile that goes along the swell, what they found is, so this is the prediction of a regular cooling plate, so it should go down the heat flow as a function of age. And what they found is this here, that the heat flow actually stays high. And this is pretty much in agreement of what you would expect if we had rejuvenation or reheating, as I indicated here. So this nicely fits this idea that the plate got reheated. The problem is, when they looked at this cross profile here, what you would expect is, if we had a heat source here, that downwind from this heat source, that this lithosphere or this plate has the youngest signature or the highest heat flow near the center in the axis, and then sort of the heat flow sort of falls off to both sides here, like a Gaussian curve or so. And then what actually happens, so these are the predictions for different types, for different thicknesses of the plate. So this is what we expect, and what they actually measured was this here. So instead of this Gaussian curve, we have a drop near the center of the island axis. And so we can't really explain this with a reheating model. It actually turns out it's quite complicated to measure the heat flow in the ocean near these islands where you have circulating water through the sediments. And it actually probably turns out, I'm not an expert in this particular field, that we have to do some corrections to these values to account for biasing effects due to that water circulation in those sediments. And maybe these values come up a little further, but who knows? So to this day, this is a little bit of a mystery why the heat flow doesn't really follow this general idea of the reheating model. Okay, so in comes the radiologist, or here at the very end, who hopefully can take pretty pictures, doesn't know exactly what they mean, but at least they can provide the pictures. And so the medical analogy of my seismology tomography is taking CAT scans, computer actual tomography of the human body. It takes a long time. If you ever have done this, this actually takes a long time to do. So they push you through this apparatus here, and then they tell you to hold still for some time, and then they out come some, eventually, slices, and hopefully a three-dimensional image of the human body or the thing that they examined. So how does this actually work? Well, if you cut into one of these machines, you actually have, just like back in the old days with a simple X-ray, you have a X-ray source. But instead of you standing in front of the source and then behind you is a film, they nowadays have a series of detectors that detect the X-rays. They measure the amount of X-ray that your body or the things in your body let through. And then what they can do is they rotate this whole machinery here around you, and you hold position, and so they illuminate you from different directions. And so that's how they get a very nicely illuminated and detailed slice of whatever they are looking at. And then they push you further into that machine, and then they get slices, one slice after the other, and then eventually they get a 3D image, a three-dimensional image. And here's just an example of a head, I guess. And you see different materials. They come up with different gray shades. So the skull, the bone, is obviously this white thing surrounding, and then in different shades of gray, the different parts of the brain. I'm the tomographer. I can't see the tumors, but at least I can provide these images. So that's what I'm trying to do with the Hawaiian magma chambers. Now, seismologists, they don't use X-rays. What we use are earthquake waves. So this map shows where on Earth the earthquakes occur, and you probably have heard that most of the earthquakes that we have, they are not randomly distributed, just like the volcanoes. Earthquakes actually are produced along these plate boundaries, just like the volcanoes. So we have, you know, these earthquakes here in subduction zones. There are actually earthquakes happening along mid-ocean ridges also, not as many as in subduction zones, or also along transform boundaries, the San Andreas Fault, for example. And so you can, or that's what we are going to do, is put instruments in a particular place that we are interested in, and then we record these earthquakes that happen around the globe, and we use these seismic waves that we record on our stations to image the ground or the interior of the Earth that is beneath us. And just as an example, I show you a tomographic image or slices thereof beneath the Iceland hotspot, which is also thought to be fed by a mantle plume. This study was done a little bit more than 10 years ago, or published 10 years ago. So what this shows here is the velocities with which the seismic waves propagate underneath the island here. And we have different types of seismic waves. We have compressional waves that come arrive first at a station, so we call this the velocity associated with them, VP. And then the second type of waves that go through the Earth are shear waves, so they are horizontally polarized or perpendicular to the direction from which they come. And the velocity associated with these waves is Vs, or the shear velocity. So what we typically show here then are these slices where the red colors are anomalies with low velocity anomalies, and the blue areas are typically where the velocities are higher. We do this because the velocities, it turns out, they depend mostly on temperature anomalies within the Earth. So basically, this then means where we have the red patches, we have anomalously hot regions. And I forgot to mention, these are different depth slices for VP and VS. This one is at 125 kilometers. This is at 300 kilometers. And here, down here, is actually a profile cut through these maps here. And then those white squares here are the stations that they placed on Iceland. One of the problems, there are several problems that are attached to doing tomography in this way, is the imaging quality actually depends how well the rays coming from these earthquakes cross your area here. If you have lots of crossing rays here, then your imaging capabilities are pretty good. If you have only earthquakes that send waves that are nearly vertical from below, and you don't have earthquakes that cross this box, then this lowers the imaging fidelity. And as you see here, and this is a little bit of a point of criticism to the tomographers, is you see here that in a cross-section, you see that these anomalies are a little bit cone-like, and they sort of resemble a little bit the ray coverage or the ray geometry with which these different earthquake waves came. So it might be, it's 100% certain that we do have this low velocity or this anomalously hot area beneath Iceland. But at larger depths here, 400 kilometers or so, it might be that the real anomaly might actually not be as wide as it is shown in this tomographic image. So the medical profession is actually a little bit advanced compared to the seismologists here, because we depend on the geometry of the earthquakes, and we cannot just put the earthquakes where we want them. We have to take what we get, unfortunately. The other thing is, which is very important, especially for Hawaii, which I'll show in a second, is you can only look as deep inside the Earth as wide your array is. So the aperture of your array is the width of that network of stations that you have, and you cannot look deeper inside the Earth than the aperture of your array. So for Iceland, you know, the island was 400 kilometers across or so, so you can look 400 kilometers deep. Well, in principle, we want to look 1,000 kilometers deep, because this controversy about this propagating crack causing the volcanism in Hawaii, or a plume, a deep-seated plume feeding the Hawaiian volcanism, we want to make sure that we have images that actually go into the lower mantle, or at least 700 kilometers or so. Well, here is the problem. So this is Iceland, and at the same scale, I'll show you Hawaii. So here is the island of Hawaii, big island. It's about 200, at its largest extent, maybe 200 kilometers across. This is Kauai here. So if you want to have an image as nice as we got for Iceland, we actually have to have instruments on the whole island chain here. But the problem is, the best that we can do in this case then is get a slice. Just one slice. We cannot get a nice 3D image when a CAT scan apparatus, the body is moved into that CAT scan apparatus, and we get a lot of slices. In this case, we would get only one slice, which is not very satisfactory. So the obvious consequence or the logical conclusion then is, well, you know, we need to put instruments out in the ocean. That's where the adventure starts. So the idea is we have a whole lot of ocean bottom instruments around the islands. First of all, we want to detect the conduit, which is thought to be only 100 kilometers in extent. So we need to have a dense network to find the actual conduit of the current volcanism. So we want to have a dense array around Hawaii, but at the same time, we also want to go deep to see how deep it goes. And so in that case, we need to have a large aperture array. Unfortunately, what we really want is to have dense stations everywhere, but the number of instruments available is very limited, and so we have to make a compromise. And it turns out, due to the limitation, the number of instruments available, we actually had to do this in two phases. And so our first phase was to place 35 ocean bottom instruments and plus 10 land stations in a network that looks like this. And then in a second phase, nearly 40 instruments in this array here with 200 kilometer station spacing around the islands of Hawaii here. So in, as a scale for a comparison, Iceland would be something like this. So a network like this would really, really get us into the deeper mantle. Well, there were some complications because with our plan, we were a little bit ahead of our time in that the instruments who could be down there for long enough to record the number of earthquakes that we need were not really built yet. So as you see, our proposal to the National Science Foundation actually got funded in 2000, but it took another 5 years of waiting and instrument development, not by myself, but by a group at Scripps and other institutes. In our case, it was the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, to build these instruments that we can go out and do our experiment. So you see, this here is actually an instrument from the Scripps group. The way this typically works is that anybody, any scientist, can actually write a proposal and then rent these instruments. I do not have to build these. These are not my instruments. I can rent these and then go out and let the ocean bottom people, the OBS people, worry about the technological things. The problem was that we wanted to have a high-quality sensor down there for a year-long deployment. And that's the problem, because the sensor draws, you know, just the power, talking power consumption for a few minutes, it draws somewhere between 500 and 800 milliwatts. And then the whole instrument package, because the data have to be recorded, which is the so-called data logger, a little computer that actually records the data. The whole package probably is somewhere around 2 watts. Now, you know, compared to a refrigerator, 2 watts is tiny. It's like a typical flashlight or something. So why is power consumption a problem? Well, the problem is that we have to do this 24/7, continuously for a whole year. And it wasn't until relatively recently that the lithium battery technology actually allowed us, was advanced enough to allow us to have these instruments, these power-hungry instruments, out there for a whole year. Okay? All right. I personally actually look at another type of wave, not the one that goes through the Earth, but actually goes along the surface, the so-called surface waves. And they are actually very comparable to waves in the water or in the ocean. So typically, this is actually just around the other side of the building here. We have this wave machine where we have a so-called monochromatic wave, surface wave of a certain wavelength. So it's about this much and with a certain period. And you see that in a real ocean or in a real water, and that actually also applies to Earth, that we actually have not only one wavelength, but a whole set of different wavelengths. Well, it turns out, unfortunately, this is not a very good experiment, but I did as best as I could here. It actually turns out if you have an earthquake or you put your finger into water or drop a coin in a water, you actually cause waves with different wavelengths. And these waves, they actually travel at different speeds. And if we can measure the different speeds of these waves with different wavelengths that sample the water column beneath that surface in a different way, we can actually extract the actual VP or the actual velocity with which the body waves would travel, which in our case with a water would actually be 1,500 meters a second. And obviously, these surface waves, they go a lot slower. So a similar thing I want to do with waves, with earthquake waves on Earth. And so we measure, this is a little bit of a busy slide here. Just to summarize, I want to measure, this is a seismic waveform. So much like this water wave that I just showed, but different wavelengths arriving at a station at different times, so they have different speeds. And then these waves with different wavelengths, they depend on the structure, on the Earth's interior in a different way. And if I can measure all these velocities for these different frequencies, and then I set up a tomographic inversion, then I can pop out these slices with the temperature anomalies just in the same way as this body wave person can do, except that I have a more clearer picture of what's going on in a plate and in the asthenosphere just below. Now, it turns out that these seismic velocities, I did say they depend on temperature, but the complication is they actually depend on a few other things also, if we want to discuss this after the lecture. Okay, a few more things about the actual cruises. We went out, this is actually the first, our first cruise was on Scripps, on a Scripps ship. Typically, you know, we send a request to NSF or to these ship operators that we want to go with them, but then a committee decides which ship, and NSF, the National Science Foundation, decides which ship you actually go on. And so the other cruises were actually on Hawaii ships. And the two last ones, the big cruises, the month-long cruises, were on the Kilo Moana, which is this interesting double-hull ship. It was actually a lot of fun. So here are the deployment and the recovery of these different types of ocean bottom seismometers or ocean bottom instruments. This one is from Woods Hole. Looks slightly different than the one here from Scripps. We worked 24/7. The transit time between these sites was about anywhere between 6 and 12 hours or so. So once we got on site, we actually had to work. So we actually also worked at night. And just to show you a little bit, this is a very compressed little movie of what was going on during a recovery. But I thought I might want to show you just how difficult it actually is to see the instrument. That person that you just saw was the captain steering the boat from the stern, because this ship is a little bit different from others. Usually we do the deployment and the recovery from the side of a ship. In this case, we actually do it from the stern, you know, and the instrument was ways out there, hard to see. And hardly above water here, but we actually got this one back. This here is actually, obviously this was during the day. If we recover these during the night, this thing here is actually a flashlight, so it's actually easier to see an instrument when it comes back to the surface at night, because that flash is really strong. So this person here is just about to hook up this instrument. Of course, it takes a lot longer than I show you here. Sometimes it doesn't happen on a first try. And actually, we have to hook it up with more than just one line. So this is coming up. Another thing that's actually very important is once the whole package is hooked up, we actually need to secure the actual sensor ball that is actually hanging below the instrument. That's coming up real quick now. We actually have to secure this sensor ball because that's still very sensitive to shaking, and we have to avoid that it's obviously banging against the stern here, so we are really concerned about this in high seas. And so this guy is hooking up the seismometer now, the actual seismic sensor, and then it's really very quick to actually get this back on the stern here. All right. Okay, so this is actually about to end here. Okay, a few things. The first deployment was relatively successful. Pele struck on our second deployment. Pele is the goddess of the Hawaiian volcanoes, and you have to make sure that you please her, otherwise she does bad things. In our case, she did bad things, unfortunately. And you see that in this area, mysteriously, in a corner, you know, you actually, when you plan these experiments, you sort of plan that not every instrument comes up. So randomly, we might lose some instruments. But Pele actually acted such a way that she took away all our instruments in this one particular corner. And we were very unhappy about this. As a scientist, you're very unhappy about this because if you lose instruments all instruments in a particular area, you lose the imaging, you lose the resolution, the imaging capabilities for this area. If you're an instrument, somebody who owns these instruments, you know, you want to know why the blast we lost these instruments. There are different theories. Maybe some batteries died, the battery in the acoustic system that allows us, when we come back after a year, to communicate to the instrument so that it releases the weight. I didn't really say this, but those yellow and the orange balls that you saw, these plastic hats, they protect glass flotation devices. And so the pressure in 5 kilometer water is very high, and it can make these glass balls implode. That was one idea. So since we were all concerned about this, NSF actually granted us a rescue cruise with a remote-operated vehicle to look and search for these instruments. Now, it turns out we actually got instruments back in two cases, and what happened in this case for two Woods Hole instruments, that they actually, so this is an image of this instrument on the ocean floor, and it turns out, I never believed this, but now I do. The operator, the owner of these instruments actually said, the sediments around Hawaii, they are so nasty that they suck things into the mud. And so even though you sort of see that it's just on the surface, it's not really obvious, but those sediments, they sucked so much that even though we had 65 pounds of buoyancy, that ground would not release that instrument after we told it to get rid of the excess weight. And so this one and another one had to be rescued with the ROV, the remote operated vehicle. Unfortunately, in five cases, this is a Scripps instrument, but it happened to the other instruments also, is indeed what happened is that these glass balls, they couldn't withstand the pressure at the ocean floor beneath 5 kilometers of water, so they imploded. And once one implodes, then all the other ones go. And then eventually, they actually also make the aluminum pressure cases implode in which the batteries are, in this case here, the acoustic system, and then also the data logger system, the computer that recorded all the seismic data. So in this case, not all was lost, but we could rescue the seismic sensors. But we couldn't get the data back in these cases, unfortunately. Okay, last few pictures. I wanted to show you the tomograms that I got with my surface waves. We actually, you know, we did get nice images. I actually had a similar proof of concept study 10 years ago where we deployed cheaper instruments, I guess simpler instruments. They didn't really have a fancy seismometer on them, but we could record the surface waves in a test deployment to the southwest of the island of Hawaii. And so you see at different depths, 60 kilometers, 100 kilometers, and 140 kilometers, so into the asthenosphere just beneath the plate, we see these strong velocities, anomalies, reaching into the asthenosphere. So what we see is a little bit, compared to the deep ocean, a little bit of that reheating, the thinning of that plate by maybe the plume, the Hawaiian plume, and then this very strong anomaly in the asthenosphere. And my conclusion from this was that this is inconsistent with this cracking lithosphere.
Inconsistent.
It cannot be explained by a cracking lithosphere, but it has to be some plume-like thing. Well, it turns out the people who defend the cracking plate or the cracking lithosphere idea, they actually tell me we could produce this type of anomaly because once the magma rises and comes up to the volcanoes, then the residue, the residual material down there changes its properties and can mimic seismically slow velocities. Okay, here's about the last image that I want to show you. This is exciting science. It's a frontier, hot topic. So anyway, what we got out from the plume deployment so far, these are initial images. The fine-tuning is still going on. First of all, the dense network does detect a relatively slow velocity anomaly, i.e. maybe hot material at about 60 kilometers. That's actually pretty confined to the island of Hawaii, so relatively small scale. An interesting thing thereby is that this relatively large anomaly does not seem to extend to greater depths. Instead, it actually stays to the west of Hawaii. And this is also confirmed when I look, unfortunately, I didn't really plot the large array on this image, but this is actually now done with a larger array. The dots down here indicate where these stations were. So the second deployment with the wider aperture confirms that these i.e. hot anomalies stay to the west of the island, which is kind of intriguing because if you think of a plume and then the Pacific plate overriding it, you would actually expect a low velocity anomaly maybe here. And for some reason, which is still puzzling us, and we try to come up with a model, we don't really find an anomaly like this. So maybe the plume is sort of migrating, and in the asthenosphere, it's actually to the west of the island of Hawaii. Now, I want you to remember what I said about the heat flow. It actually sort of is nicely consistent with the heat flow data that said, yeah, we do have some heat anomaly to the west of the islands. Okay, I think I'm at the end of my presentation, and I would like to thank very much the OBS folks that made this experiment possible. The persons named here are people from the
Scripps OBS team. Here we have actually John Collins. He is from the Woods Hole team. He is also from the Woods Hole team here. And Bobby here also. And actually lots, whenever I went to see, I had actually lots of students with me from different countries of the world. Actually, that was very international, and they all helped in a watch standing, taking cruise logs, and they really enjoyed themselves. So that was enjoyable. The question is, why would a deep plume stay at the same place, whether there wouldn't be any mixing going on? That is a good question. I'm not really sure if I can actually answer this very quickly. I think the bulk of the circulation, the mantle convection, is thought to be driven by the subducting slabs, and that's where the mixing is going on, actually also into the deep mantle. And so the places away from plate boundaries are thought of sort of stay in place for a relatively long time compared to what's going on along the plate boundaries. Very good question. The question was, do I have any idea how long the glass balls lasted? Since we recovered the seismometers, there was actually the seismometers inside itself. They have a small computer that sort of recorded the time when it tried to readjust the tilting, the orientation of the vertical component of the seismometer. From those data, we know that there was no single event that took out all the seismometers at the same time. From these records, we also know that each of these were down there for some time, for many, many months before they failed. So we know they did not fail upon impact. And they did not fail as a result of a certain event. There was some conspiracy theory out. The captain actually suggested, well, the Navy was actually doing an experiment in that area at that time. So maybe there was a huge explosion down there that took the instruments out. But no, this most likely did not happen. Okay, the question was, since I imaged something to the west of Hawaii, if that could be an artifact due to the fact that we have less instruments to the east of the islands. Can we turn the camera off? Yes, this is a possibility. It is a possibility. However, we do have some coverage on the eastern side of the islands, and I don't see anything. There were some previous studies that did try to do 3D imaging with stations that were only deployed on the islands. There is limited, but there is some coverage in the deeper mantle, in the transition zone. And they did not find anomalies to the east either, only to the west. So that would be consistent to the story that I see.
That's it. I want to thank you very, very much.
Well, thanks for having me. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.